The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning and welcome to Nature Nuggets here on Radio Kingston. My name's Chris Baker and I'm be filling in for Laurel Sutherland for the whole month of February. So Radio Kingston's commitment to building community and helping us feel a sense of belonging in the place where we live brings so much joy and connection to our town. Laurel started the Nature Nuggets show to help expand that definition of community to embrace our more than human kin, and to help folks get to know the astounding biodiversity of plants, animals, fungi, and microorganisms we're so fortunate to share space with every day here in the Hudson Valley. Filling in for Laurel is always a joy because his mission for Nature Nuggets feels like a natural extension of the other work that I do. I'm the founder of Chicory Naturalist, which is a nature-focused book and gift shop at the Kingston Waterfront. We carry a curated selection of books and guides for all ages, as well as board games, gear, toys, art supplies, anything that helps folks learn about and appreciate nature. We have a really comfy seating area in the back and a play area for kids so that community members of all ages can come read and relax. And we host a lot of community events throughout the year, including book club coming up. We're really try to have a little something for everyone because, after all, nature is for everyone. And now more than ever, our world really needs every one of us to take an interest in her. As Laurel says, people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. Okay, so now it's time for Who's About Town, which is a segment sort of like the Society Pages, but for people who consider birds more interesting than celebrities. And you know, recently, I'm not just thinking about birds, I'm really worrying about them. And yeah, I'm talking about the dreaded bird flu. And I've been so focused, and I think reasonably so, given everything we've been through, on the possibility that bird flu could become the next human pandemic. Until recently, I wasn't as tuned into the fact that it has already become a panzootic, which is a disease affecting many species of animals in a widespread scale. We don't really know the real impacts at this point, and that's maybe one of the scariest parts of it, but we do know that many millions of wild birds and mammals have died in the past year. Just this year, 19 million farmed birds, mostly chickens, have had to be killed because of the spread of the disease in farms. So quite apart from the potential impacts for humans, the current strain of H1N1 is really just devastating for wildlife. And recently, as I've been paying more attention to that news, I've been watching my backyard birds and worrying for them. This week, we've had a lot of dark-eyed juncos, cardinals, jays, house finches, sparrows, and other songbirds come to visit our yard. We don't have a feeder at our house, but we do, like, we leave our flower seed heads, as we'll talk about later in the hour, uncut until the spring so that the birds can come and browse. And so I've been worried, are these sweet little friends just doomed? But reading more this week, according to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, hawks, eagles, falcons, owls, crows, vultures, shorebirds, game birds, seabirds, and especially waterfowl are at high risk from the highly pathogenic avian influenza. But there is just a tiny little bit of good news, which is that the current strain poses a very low risk to songbirds. So if you've been wondering whether to take down your bird feeder this winter, currently there's no recommendation to do so. The exception to this rule will be if you have backyard chickens, because chickens are sadly very susceptible to respiratory diseases. So keeping them apart from other wildlife that could be carrying the virus is a top concern right now. I apologize for bringing a downer of a topic to Who's About Town right now, but as we've learned these past years, viruses are big players in our ecosystems. Obviously, the bird flu situation is ever evolving, but allaboutbirds.org, which is the website for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, has really great resources to keep you abreast as things change. All right, so on to sunnier topics. Today, I have a really special guest with me in the studio. I'm so excited that she's here with me. Sephra Alexandra, aka the Seed Huntress, has dedicated her life to the preservation of global seed biodiversity. With years of experience and a passion for her work, Sevra has become a leading voice in the field of seed conservation. Her tireless efforts have led to the creation of numerous seed banks and the development of new techniques for preserving our global seed heritage. While Sevra's work has spanned many parts of the globe, she's rooted in our bioregion, leading the Ecotype Project and botanical expeditions, which we'll get into soon, as well as serving on the steering committee of the Northeast Seed Network. Thank you so much for being here, Sevra.
Thanks for having me, Chris. And when I first found Chicory Naturalist, it was like walking into an oasis of my dreams, right? Like if you could have a treehouse with every book you ever wanted and every game and every nature fun activity, that is what the Chicory Naturalist is like. So thank you for having that space here in Kingston.
That is such, having that reflected back from somebody is so lovely, because I do want it to feel like that clubhouse, that treehouse. So to start us off, do you have any potentially more cheerful deep winter observations to share with listeners today?
Sure. I mean, just hearing you talk about the birds, and I know how much we both love books, I would say to look into a book called What the Robin Knows by John Young. Actually, when I was at Cornell doing my graduate degree, he came and spoke at the Lab of Ornithology, and basically it talks about the language of birds. And if we can understand what the birds are doing, then you know what's happening for miles around you, right? They're the scouts of the forest. So when they flush down, there's like an aerial predator. They flush up, there's a ground predator. And it's just a really fun book if you're into bird watching to understand more about what's happening with them. And I took my dog Lex on a beautiful walk yesterday up in Platte Clove. And the Catskills are
beautiful.
Yeah, they're so amazing. There's such abundant different types of hardwoods and waterfalls. And I'm so grateful to live in such a beautiful area. And I don't know if most people think that winter's a time where everything's dead, but in my mind, everything's so alive, right? You see the catkins on all the different trees. And from a native seed perspective, right, I'm thinking of all the seeds that are sleeping underneath that snow. And they need to go through this period of cold to actually be able to grow and sprout in the spring. And so I think in terms of like humans as well, right? This is the time of rest and regaining our strength and our energy so that we can germinate come spring. And so it just seems like such an abundant and beautiful time. And looking at all the tracks in the snow and seeing what little creatures are still playing around and watching the chickadees play. Have you had some winter observations?
Yeah, no, I love thinking about the seeds at this time of year. I also think a lot about the buds. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. if you tune into it, you think of like, oh, spring feels so far away. But every day, like the buds on the trees are getting a little bit bigger, and they're already there. They're just waiting.
And they're so beautiful. And now such a fun time to practice like identifying trees by their bark.
Yeah.
And their winter buds.
And Yeah. I know the bark I always want to get better at, because it's hard to pay attention to. There's so much that when everything is blooming and flowering and tweeting, you know, it's like sort of like sensory overload. And I love this time of year for being able to really like focus also on like the boundary layer organisms, the lichens and mosses and things that it's really kind of hard to pay attention to.
Boundary layer. Well, I've never heard that term before.
Oh, yeah. It's I learned about it from Gathering Moss, Robin Mulcamer's first mm-hmm. book, which is a great book. Highly recommend. But she talks about basically the layer. It's a physics concept, but the layer just against the surface of anything, everything, has different physical properties than the air above it. So that's why basically, because of like air currents, then the way they flow in ways that I don't totally understand, but she has great little diagrams about it. It creates these microclimates, which is what allows like a lot of mosses to be green, even, you know, in February, because they're actually living in sort of their own little rainforests, basically.
Well, I have to say, the chartreuse, if someone had to ask me my favorite color palette, I would go like lichen, right?
Yes, yes.
And the bryophytes are just so exciting because, they're able to be so vibrant throughout the year. And then speaking of seeds, when you look and how much moisture that those moss beds hold, that is like the perfect place where you see so many seeds start to germinate and sprout.
Oh, I didn't know that they sprout in the moss because they hold, Well, that's about the boundary layer.
Yeah, so that boundary layer, yeah. There's a seed party happening and a spore party too.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Think about the, because they germinate from spores, but they're holding the seeds with them.
Yeah, exactly. Really
it's like the ancestral. And
there's probably some tardigrades in there. If you don't know what a tardigrade, do you know what a tardigrade is?
Yes, but you can tell listeners if you want.
Okay. Them. Basically, they look like a manatee or they're microscopic. But they can survive the hottest hots, the coldest cold. They're in every biome and terrestrial environment in the world, and they can survive anything, right? They look like they're wearing a little spacesuit.
They're animals too. They're microscopic animals. They're like, they're so tiny.
Yeah, look up a tardigrade if you can, because they are the coolest looking creatures, and there's studies being done. I was actually in Poland. I got to go to like the World Tardigrade Conference because my brother and I, we were doing disaster response work there with our company Tactivate, but there's all these people that study them because their ability to basically go into a dehydrated state for like a year or be in is temperatures as hot as volcanoes or in the freezing tundra, and then they're still able to come back alive.
Yeah.
And I mean, I make the correlation, right, when we think of seeds that have been found in, you know, old ruins that will grow to after 2,000 years. And so there's so many things in nature that know how to, right now there's hibernation, and I think you pronounce it like brumation when you see the turtles and you think of all the fish in the ponds that are just kind of like in a suspended animation.
Yeah. And like a frozen frog under the duff, just like little frog popsicle waiting for the spring.
And then they come back.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Great job, nature.
Yeah. So I'd love to talk about how you first fell in love with seeds. Seeds feel like one of those topics that once somebody falls down the rabbit hole, they're usually there for the long haul. But I'm curious what your initiation story was.
Well, I'm grateful for my family growing up. Like we spent a lot of our time just going on adventures out in the forest, and my twin brother and I would make a bunch of forts, and you know, you pick up an acorn and you realize that this little acorn grows these mighty oaks, and there's, you know, just always that awe and that reverence for these living little embryos that have such amazing embedded power, that are this unbroken chain since time immemorial of like all the squirrels and the chipmunks or the human ancestors, right, that have helped to steward and pass these seeds down. So I think I've always just been in awe that way. And my brother and I grew up going to Tom Brown Jr. Tracker School, like wilderness awareness skill schools.
I think you're maybe the second person I've interviewed on the show who's been there.
Yeah. And I mean, Tom Brown Jr. recently just passed on, but his lineage and the schools that he started, I've worked with a number of them, Primitive Pursuits in Ithaca and the Roots School that sort of comes from that same lineage up in Vermont. You know, we grew up with the mindset that the wilderness has everything that you need, right? Like, and if you can learn how to live within that environment and caretake and steward it and understand how to utilize the resources that are available to you, then this whole world of possibility comes up to just spend all of your time outside. So that was really the beginning. And then I would say permaculture was kind of my gateway drug to seeds. And I became a permaculture instructor, lived at my first eco village, the Sirius community in Massachusetts, and then went and did a permaculture teacher training at Esalen. Have you ever been to Esalen?
No.
They call it like the Taj Mahal of the hippie movement, right? It's in Big Sur. There's hot springs. It's where like, Ken Kesey and all of them, like where their kids went to school in an outside, you know, feral child type of schoolyard. It's this amazing place, but they do wonderful education courses. And I took a teacher training. And while there, I met my mentors, Bill and Belle McDormand. and they were running the seed bank at Native Seed Search in Arizona. And that's the seed bank that has been helping for the tribes of the Southwest, the Hopi, the Tarahumara, the Navajo, safeguard their seeds. And they did an ancient grains course. And I went, and it was kind of the moment where I walked in to the seed bank and I saw all these seeds in their resplendent splendor. And I just kind of fell to my knees and I was like, seeds.
Can you describe like what a seed bank, I think I have a picture in my head, but I don't know if it's what it really looks like what a seed bank looks like for listeners?
Sure.
And I mean, what a seed bank is?
Yeah.
People
so
familiar.
So think about when, you know, most seed banks, right? There's all different varieties, whether we're talking about a community seed bank, right? Which is what we helped to build in the southern part of Haiti after a natural disaster. A community seed bank will be a place where people can locally access their bioregionally adapted seeds, the seeds that know how to grow in Haiti. And that can look like seeds in whatever glass jars exist around, or even in sacks and bags. You want it to stay at a cool and constant temperature. You want to be monitoring humidity because you want seeds to stay cool, dark, and dry. Right.
Yep.
The general rule of thumb, which I know you know because you've worked with Kay Green at Hudson Valley Seed Company.
Cool, dark, and dry. It's a good rule of thumb. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the main rule of thumb. So community seed banks, yeah, there's like sacks and there's jars. You get up more to like the international seed banks. When I was a fellow for the World Seed Bank, if you think about Svalbard, the global seed vault in Norway, right, you can think about every country in the world sends a backup of their cultural heritage, the seeds that have been, you know, their taste of place, the terroir, whether it's their grains or their beans, excuse me. They send a package of those seeds, and those are ones that have been really desiccated, really dried out. And then you have like silica, you know, like when you get a new pair of shoes, those like silica sacks. Yeah, put those in there. Or you put them in Mylar, which is like those space blankets, those emergency blankets. There's bags like that. And there's all different strategies for making sure those seeds stay dry and they maintain their viability for as long as possible. But basically, just think about when you go to the bulk section of like your natural food store. Put all of those in gorgeous jars and line them up in shelves in like a cold storage area. And that is the glory of a seed bank.
Wow, it sounds so beautiful.
It is so beautiful.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, yeah. If you think about nature's elegant design, right, where they can take every tree, every shrub, every flower that we love when we're walking in the wilderness or botanical garden, when all of that gets distilled down to these beautiful little, I mean, they're almost like gems, or they're such treasures when you walk through and just seeing the difference in size and shape and color.
And all the adaptations for how they get around the world.
Yes, I love all those words. There's so many fun words like animockery, right?
What is animockery?
Well, or animochory, depending on your pronunciation of it. It's the dispersal of seeds by wind.
Oh, yes.
So we think about our dandelions and kind of when you see all of those. So a pappus is that fluffy back part of the seed that is like that parachute that allows it to fly through the air. Because seeds all have different dispersal mechanisms, because ultimately what they're trying to do is get away from their parents a little bit and kind of have their own space to grow and proliferate. So nature has all of these amazing strategies, hydrochory, dispersal of seeds by water. Think like the coconut floating along the water, or just when we're paddling on the Hudson and you see all of those.
The water chestnut.
All those invasive trapanets. Actually for the water chestnuts, my partner's mom, Nikki, and I started this great initiative called the Plant Pirates, where I say, take all, leave nothing. And we've been working up at the Saugerties Lighthouse, removing the water chestnuts.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's great.
And it's super fun. And
do you have that, the boat that you get to steer around?
No, okay. We've kind of just had 5-gallon buckets and a good attitude, you know?
Oh, that's, there's like I don't know exactly.
A harvester, I've heard
of. Yeah,
about.
There's like a harvester down at, because I'm in Esopus, down there that I like desperately want to drive because it looks like a lot of fun. But yeah.
I think we should do that. Get our like our harvester captain's licenses. Yeah, but and then the funny thing about, you know, trapanatins is in permaculture farms in like Asia, that is the first thing that they plant as an aquatic vegetable.
Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate that like our only solution is just like composting, because it's like, yeah, it's a food stuff. Yeah.
And it's supposed to be an amazing one that has like this amazing flavor profile. But the problem, of course, with the Hudson is, are those seeds uptaking any of the chemicals or the pollution that's in the Hudson? And so doing some tests around that, in no way are we recommending eating them out of the Hudson. But maybe in the future that could be like a value-added crop. And when you can add value to these invasive species, maybe that can help eradicate them.
I mean, that's pretty good incentive to try to get a cleaner river, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll return with our conversation in just a few minutes after a short break to hear some words for the community.
The A.J. Williams Myers African Roots Center and Radio Kingston celebrate Black History Month. Born and raised in Yonkers, New York, with roots in Greenburg, Vinnie Bagwell's artistic journey began as a young student, where she first dipped her brush into the world of painting. But it was in 1993 that she ventured into sculpting. Despite having no formal training, her talent shone bright. In 1996, the city of Yonkers recognized her genius with a commission for the First Lady of Jazz, Ella Fitzgerald. Her dedication even led her to replace the controversial J. Marion Sims sculpture in Central Park with Victory Beyond Sims. As she has been recognized with prizes, awards, and many other honors, Vinnie's legacy flows through her art, touching hearts and inspiring change as her creations remind us of the strength and resilience of African Americans. My name is Frank Waters, and this has been a Black History Month moment from the A.J. Williams Myers African Roots Center and Radio Kingston.
Are you ready to get active and thrive? Come join us at the YMCA. I'm Heidi Kirshner, CEO, President of the YMCA, and we're excited to offer you a wide range of activities for everyone. Fitness classes, youth sports, swim lessons, diabetes prevention, blood pressure monitoring, and vibrant community events. It's the perfect place to build friendships, stay active, and make a positive impact on your community. Visit your local YMCA today on Broadway in Kingston, or at ymcaulster.org. We can't wait to see you.
As part of Black History Month, Kingston New Vines Strong Roots is hosting a Valentine's Day paint and sip at the Center for Creative Education on Friday, February 14th. Bring a friend or a loved one for an evening of art and fun. This event will be a fundraiser for New Vines Strong Roots 2025 Kingston Reunion, which will take place on July 25th through the 27th. Valentine's Day Paint and Sip, Friday, February 14th at 4 p.m. at the Center for Creative Education, 16 Cedar Street in Kingston. For more information, visit the events page at radiokingston.org. Great, so welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm Chris Baker, and I'm here today with Sephra Alexandra, a.k.a. the Seed Huntress. And we've been talking about everything seeds, and as Sephra is just this incredible wealth of knowledge about seeds, I'm sure we can literally talk about it all hour if we wanted to. But I do want to also talk about some of the specific projects that you're involved with, of which I know there are several. But I'm really curious about the EcoType project. And if you could just tell listeners what it is and where it's based.
Sure. And I love the name Nature Nuggets, right? And I think the true wisdom's in these seeds. And I don't think anything's a better nature nugget than seeds.
Oh, absolutely. It's the ultimate nature nugget.
Okay. So let's get ready for a couple definitions, right? Because I think there's a lot of vernacular that goes along with the seed world. And it's actually pretty intuitive once you understand the meaning behind it. So
break it down for us.
Okay. Let's break it down. So an ecotype. Okay, so when you're walking out in, let's say, Platte Clove, right? Now, these whole conversations around native, not native, we can get into that a little bit. Of course, you could have an entire hour or month-long show just in that discourse. But what we're talking about when we talk about ecotypes or ecotypic seed are truly genetically local native seeds from areas that haven't had human influence or disturbance, right? And of course, in our modern day, those are few and far between. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is safeguard the heirlooms of the pollinators, the plants that have been here co-evolving with the wildlife that's around here since time immemorial, however long that may be. And so what the Ecotype Project is doing is addressing our national seed strategy. So in 2010, the National Seed Strategy came out all across the country, where we have, you know, the wildfires out west. We have all of these anthropogenic or human-made cities, and we're destroying all these natural areas. It's okay, don't worry. This isn't a doom and gloom, because seeds are so powerful, and the ROI, the return on investment. You plant one seed, the next year you get thousands. So it's okay, everyone. We can totally fix this. But the problem is, the country said, when these types of events happen, we don't have a backup in Oregon, in California, in New York, of the seed that's truly genetically local or ecotypic to that place to be able to restore that environment. I think a lot of times people have been talking about conservation, but you can't conserve an area that's been disrupted or destroyed. At that point, you move into ecological restoration. And to do proper ecological restoration, you need that adapted, genetically ecotypic local seed species to be able to restore that environment so that the pollinators go, oh yeah, I recognize the taste of that. I know how that looks, right? So I think just to, does that help define the ecotype?
No, absolutely. And I think that that's a more, in some ways, helpful framework than the idea of native or not native, invasive species, of just really focusing on what's the coevolution that we're trying to facilitate, or what are we trying to bring back into balance in an ecosystem? Which I think can feel really, we were talking a little off mic, but about how overwhelming it can be for people who are, I mean, obviously when it comes to conservation, there's whole parks that people are trying to bring back into balance. But there's also just everybody who gets a little piece of land, the place where they live, and is trying to, you know, make sure it's not exclusively garlic mustard. So,
pesto.
Yeah, trying to create some biodiversity in their own yard.
Well, the native question, okay, so if we keep on going down the definition lane here for a second, you know, you think of the great work of Doug Tallamy, and you think of all these amazing advocates, Two Thirds for the Bird, Edwina von Gaal, so many amazing people trying to make this better understood. And if any of you have native pollinator plants in your backyards and you've bought your native species from Home Depot, then great job. The pollinators need all that they can get, right? But what we're doing with this project is elevating it to what is the best possible plant material that we could be putting in our yard. And so when you think about a milkweed that you buy,
I was gonna say, I feel like milkweed's a great example of this.
Milkweed's a great example, right? We have our charismatic monarch that everyone wants to save. And excuse me, on the radio you feel like you have to clear your throat. But if you buy a milkweed from Tennessee, right, and you put it in your landscape here in New York, you can say, oh, look at all these monarchs. They're all feeding off this. This is so exciting. But the problem is, those milkweeds may have slightly different bloom times because they were adapted to the Minnesota or wherever the big nursery was, bloom times. And monarchs are on a 5-year migration. So if they're staying at your garden too long, the domino effect, they might be missing the bloom times all the way down the coast. So when we think about the importance of using what's bioregionally or ecoregionally adapted, it's because when we look ecologically, right, there's a lot more going on than just the part that we see in our backyard.
Yeah, so. I think that for migrating species, I mean, that's just taking that 5-year migration. I mean, I think that's kind of hard to even wrap your head around that, like, because it's multiple generations of the monarch that pass through and come back.
Yeah.
And, like, by that, you think that you're seeing, you know, a quicker cycle than you really are when you see monarchs come through your yard. And that's just one example of all of the many, you know, organisms that are dependent on plants and their
so gifts. Many, right? Because we have, like, our generalist native plant species that can feed a bunch of different pollinators. But then you have these specialists that, like, without that one plant, you won't see that one species. And so what we did with the Ecotype Project is we looked at the National Seed Strategy, which was a call out to the whole country saying, how are we going to increase the amount of native seed that we have available to do this restoration? And so you go out to, like, the great seed growing capitals of our country in Oregon, and they have huge amounts of land, huge combines, you know, amazing machinery to be able to do that. But you come to the fragmented landscapes of the Northeast, and it's like, we don't really have that much room to be able to do all these things. So what we had to do here was make a new supply chain template. And so what we did is we worked with botanists and seed collectors, right, who actually know how to identify the right species, who get permission, because we're not just encouraging everyone to go out to these last fragmented wild areas.
And then, like, pillage the
seeds. And then pillage. Yeah. Like, we don't want it to be what happens with foraging, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I'm a big advocate of foraging and medicine making and all those great things, but it needs to be done responsibly. And when you're educated and trained how to do it, you know, when we look at how Allium trichocum ramps are sometimes taken out, if they're not harvested properly, you wipe out that stand for the next year. And so in terms of having, like, a regenerative mindset of how you can actually, you know, do these things in an ecological way, there's just a bit of knowledge that needs to go with it. And so permissions and all of those things are important. And then so we take those species, let's say the milkweed or the broadleaf mountain mint, and then we train farmers how to grow the specialty crop of the seed, right? And so we've worked with a lot of organic farmers, and we teach them how to grow that crop, when to collect the seed, and then we clean it, and then started a seed company from that to make those seeds commercially available.
Oh, so there, so the Ecotype Project has a, like, a business end of it?
So the Ecotype Project is the nonprofit seed literacy education training part of it, and the Northeast Seed Collective is the seed company. So now, you know, for 5 years I was talking to people about ecotypes, and everyone said, oh, we want it, we want to buy it, where can we go? And it was like, well, there's the Wild Seed Project in Maine, which, by the way, they're amazing. And now finally we can say, well, there's the Northeast Seed Collective. And this gets a little confusing, but through the Northeast Seed Network, we're aggregating all of these little seed hubs that are now training farmers in each of their states and their areas to grow seed that we can sell through the collective.
That is so cool. Okay, so which brings me to how can listeners get involved? Because so there's actually a way that people can purchase the seeds this year?
Totally. And now is a great time to do winter sowing, right? Because as we talked about in the beginning with our winter nature observations, those seeds have to go through that freeze. That's, you know, you think about the seeds blow off the native plants, they fall into the snow, and then they have to go through that freeze, thaw, snow, sun. And that's what is cold stratifying them. That's what they're adapted to do to be able to grow. Now, don't be intimidated. Any listeners out there who haven't done this, look up winter sowing. You basically can take a milk jug, you poke holes in the bottom, you put some potting or seed mix in it, you sow your seeds, and like if you cut the jug in half, and then just leave it outside, right? And let nature do its thing. Because I think oftentimes we think, like, we're going to start a native seed meadow, and you just broadcast all your seed. What you're really doing is throwing out expensive bird food, right? The birds and the mice and everything, they're all hungry too. So if you look up winter sowing, it's a way to put the seeds out now, but you're, you know, covering it up with some hardware cloth. You want to protect it from the birds and the mice and everyone else who's hungry. And then in the spring, you'll see all these little babies come up. So,
and you can do it in your fridge too, if you want, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, you would roll it in basically like a paper towel that was moist, not soaking wet. And depending on species, they need to be in the fridge for 30, 60, or 90 days. But again, like, nature wants to live. And these seeds have such inherent wisdom of, like, some sleep for a year, some sleep for 2 months, some, you know, because if they all woke up at the same time and it was a bad season, then they would all get wiped out. So I encourage you all just to look up some fun ways to do winter sowing. Great to do with kids. And now's exactly the right time.
Yeah. In bulk, right? Yeah. just past it. Yeah, I think when I used to work at the Hudson Valley Seed Company and I would talk to people, I did like their customer service line. So I'd talk a lot of people through. And I think that like growing from seed can feel intimidating to a lot of people just because there are a lot of, it feels like there's a lot of specific knowledge because every seed comes with its own sort of instruction manual, and that can feel a little overwhelming. And I think, but when you break it, I think in some ways learning about the provenance of a seed and thinking about where it is adapted to originally actually really simplifies the project of learning how to grow from seed, because you're like, well, what did it need in nature? Like, what was it? What kind of conditions helped it grow? And it's like, yeah, if it's a Northeast adapted seed, like we were talking about milkweed, also just a ton of native wildflower, basically all the native wildflowers and mixes that you might get have that kind of adaptation. Or versus like, if you're like, I'm trying to grow my own tomatoes, like, well, that's a tropical plant, right? So it's going to need, you're going to have to put heat on it to get that seed to sprout. And
thinking of provenance is like exactly the perfect way to think about seed. And being able to work for the Hudson Valley Seed Company, Kay Green has been such a, I call him seed celebrities. Like, he's definitely a seed celebrity because he really helped bring the whole seed library movement. You know, making seeds available at your library so you can check it out, and then you check back in at the end of the season, seeds that have adapted to your place. And
talk about an idea that just takes off because the time has come. You know what I mean? I feel like that was such a amazing contribution.
It was such an amazing contribution. And now they're everywhere. And I mean, we brought back a heirloom onion in Connecticut and started a seed library, and you're able to give out seeds for free. But I think that's a different conversation. But I think one of the things that Kay Green they coined that term seed shed, right?
Yeah. Like a watershed, but a seed shed. Yeah.
Right. So we learn our watershed and we learn our food sheds, right? Know who your farmer is, get your seeds from closer by. And now it's this concept of how do we build these seed sheds? How can we be collecting, growing, and resharing seeds within a localized area? And I think that goes, again, back to what the Ecotype Project did, is because we wanted to create a format for doing this type of seed supply along an eco-regional framework. So back to our definitions. The Environmental Protection Agency, a wonderful gentleman there named James Obernick, he said, if we want to do true conservation and restoration, we can't be working along these man-made lines of here's Connecticut, here's Massachusetts, here's New York, and here's Rhode Island. Said, you know, when we put our bug eyes on, we see the broadleaf forest, the riparian, the coastal areas. And so what he did is he took the data sets from, you know, the forestry, the ornithology, the hydrology, the geology, all the ologies, right? And he overlaid them. And he said, from a broad stroke scientific perspective, these are areas that from a seed, you know, from what we're talking about with seeds, you can collect and proliferate these seeds along these eco-regional boundaries, mm-hmm. and you can know you're putting the right plants in the right place. So in Connecticut, we're eco-region 59, and that actually comes up into the Hudson Valley, which is why the Northeast Seed Collective has Eco 59 seed. And then you have eco-region 84, which we're starting to have seeds from. Think of like the Nantuckets, Martha's Vineyards, Block Islands, and then eco-region 59, which is getting more up into other parts of
So New York. Here in Kingston, we're in 58, you said?
This is 59.
This is 59.
Yeah,
okay,
so, cool. So the reason, again, why that's important is just because we were talking about the native seeds that you would get from the Midwest, right? Which have different bloom times. Or oftentimes when you're buying from the Home Depots to the bigger nurseries, they're nativars. They're grown from cuttings. So perhaps we've all heard of the downfalls of monocultures, right? When we have our bananas, or when I studied taro in the South Pacific, or the Irish potato famine, when you have just one genetic strain that's proliferated
it's
across
landscapes. It's basically the same species, I mean, the same individual, really, with bananas, right? It's like not even the same, not just one species, it's just like one banana.
Yeah, so all the diversity of Musa was basically bred out. Musa's just, the banana family, and I know I go off into many divergent topics, but there's so many exciting things to talk about with seeds. There's actually crop wild relatives of, a crop wild relative, right, is traditionally all, as you were saying when you were talking about the provenancing of tomatoes and all these things, traditionally all of our cultivated crops come from somewhere in the earth. Right. And Nikolai Vavilov, who was the first person Russian, he was the first person to go around the world and say, hey, these seeds, we should collect these and safeguard these and start a seed bank because these are really important to humanity. And he also noticed the centers of diversity. Where crops first emerge in the world is where they have the most amount of diversity. So potatoes in Peru, pulses and grains in India.
I like coffee.
Yeah. And he was able to map out the world's crops by where their centers of origin, where they emerged. So, and that's where our global seed banks sit to protect the 150,000 varieties of maize and wheat in southern Mexico, right? And rice in the Philippines. But what happens is when you want to safeguard our cultivated crops, sometimes they grow weak because you're planting these monocultures, these like one tomato variety, these one banana variety that we rely on for our foodstuffs. So you have to go back out on seed hunting expeditions, back out to the centers of origin.
To reestablish like the genetic diversity of a crop?
Yeah, and regain that wild vigor, right? So when our banana crops are almost falling into disrepair, the Crop Trust, who oversees the World Seed Banks, they did a crop wild relatives expedition to go out to the world to recollect those banana seeds of the little pink bananas and the purple bananas. And this wonderful gentleman, Anthony, just actually wrote a book about all the diversity of bananas. But I digress. And what it is to say is, we have to be careful, like with the nativars, right? When we're relying on these monoculture, genetic monocultures, they become susceptible to any blight, like the blight that wiped out the Southport globe onion in Southport. And then we lose this important global food crop. And so you have to rely on the diversity held in seed banks to rebreed these crops. But for this work, the best possible form of seed conservation is in the living seed bank. Is in the soil, right? So as much as that we can have the genetic diversity of place from here, these seeds are so smart. And as we've grown them with our farmers, some years when we have a really wet year and you only have a couple of your seed crops actually be successful and you're like, oh, it's a failed seed crop. You're like, no, these seeds have the inherent genetic wisdom to know how to survive a drought or a flood, or they're the most resistant to whatever fluctuations there are. So when we're saving these ecotypes, these native seeds, we want to save as much of these beautiful arcs of diversity as exist to be able to adapt to however climates shift in the future.
And when people buy from so there's the Northeast Seed Network, but this is the Northeast Seed
Collective.
Collective is the where people can buy from.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you buy from the Northeast Seed Collective and you plant in your own yard and you are, in a lot of ways, you're stewarding that seed for the next generations of that plant. Like, is there a way that then people are asked to, share back the seed? Or is there a process for that?
So to help clarify, the Northeast Seed Network is what's aggregating the botanists, the farmers, the nurseries, the seed extractories, mm-hmm. which are the places where you clean seed, all of the people that are working on it from like a professional, quote unquote, perspective. And if you're a farmer out there and you want to get involved, reach out to the Northeast Seed Network or Northeast Seed Collective. But I think, you know, so the farmers that we train, their seeds can be sold because they have to go through standards and protocols and best practices to be able to be sold at the Northeast Seed Collective. But let's say you plant some of these ecotypic species in your own backyard. Well, if you're a part of a garden club or a part of
you
any
just
like
pass it forward.
Yeah, you come to the chicory naturalist, you know, again, like seeds are so encouraging because you plant one and the next year you literally are collecting thousands. And so let's say in your own backyard you want to remove invasive species and have native species proliferate. Well, start small, right? Winter sow your seeds. You take those little babies, you upot them, and then you plant them out into an area, a little area that you've cleared. And year by year, like concentric rings, those native plants will start to outcompete with the invasives as you kind of open up space. And then you can collect and save and re-germinate your own seed that you're growing, and you'll have thousands and thousands and thousands of plants. You can share them with your friends and share them with your garden clubs and share them with your groups. And then that fortifies those seed sheds that we were talking about. So I think just, yeah, sharing it with your neighbors is the best way to make these pollinator pathways, these ecological corridors.
I love that. That's, I think, a great call to action too, because it feels very, it's very pro-social also, you know, like when you're sharing seed and you're, with your neighbors, you're also talking to your neighbors, yeah, which is really great. I do think, like, yeah, talking a little bit to the challenges of ecological restoration, which I know is part of some of the other work that you do as well. I think, like, when you're just removing endless amounts of, you know, Creeping Charlie or, as we said, garlic mustard, or when it just feels like kind of like that part in Fantasia with Mickey and the broom. It's, yeah, just like you take one out and you're like, oh no, I didn't get the roots, and now there's four more where because plants are, you know, nothing if not,
yeah, they have their little
awesome and survivor.
Totally.
But so I was curious from and maybe we can talk about it after the next break as well, but the botanical expeditions. But do you have, like, some success stories? Because I know, I'm sure you do, about ecological restoration that could help give people a little bit of hope when they start to feel a little underwater with their own restoration projects.
Yeah. I mean, I think our great colleague who's on the steering committee with us at the Northeast Seed Network, Linda, and her partner, they run the Wildwoods Restoration Project, which is like an hour south from here. But if you want to volunteer and learn about seed collecting, if you want to see one of the most amazing restoration projects where they've taken out all these invasives and they have a thriving understory ecosystem, then I would say volunteer and go see that. And that will be, their work has been so encouraging. And I think, I don't know how long we have till we take a break, but the botanical expeditions, right? With all of this ecotype project work, we said we want to get more people involved. We want to get people involved who may not otherwise care about seeds or ecological restoration. So I said, I'm not a botanist, I'm a botanist. And I take citizen scientists, kids, everyone, and say, instead of going on an expedition, right, in the Himalayas, let's go in our own backyards. Let's steward and caretake these areas. And so what we've done is we've taken these ecotypic plants and we've paddled down the Connecticut River or in a whole bunch of different states. And we get permission from these different areas or farms that are right off the riverway. And we help to take out invasive plants and make these seed increase beds, which is where we plant like 200 of these ecotype plants for the production of the seed crop. And I think the encouraging part that we've seen about this is once these plants are again back in that living seed bank in the soil, then there's all of these dispersal mechanisms that we were talking about before. Myrmecophagy, dispersal by ants, ornithochory, dispersal by birds, zoochory by animals when it gets caught to your dog's fur, and anthropocry, dispersal of seeds by human. And we have such a beautiful role to play in helping steward these native plants to be back in their ecosystem that it's just really fun. And you can even use slingshots where we have like these seed balls that you have them at Chicory Naturalist. And just nature knows what to do. So let's just put these plants back in on the landscape. And
oh my gosh, that's so inspiring. And we'll return to our conversation after a few words from the community.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Allende Rodriguez from the Public Utility Law Project. If you are one of the million plus New Yorkers behind on your utility bills and you're stressed thinking about how you'll be able to pay your winter heating bill, you may be eligible for the Home Energy Assistance Program, known as HEAP. The HEAP applications are open and you can apply online or in person. You can visit mybenefits.ny.gov to learn more and see if you meet income requirements or call Ulster County DSS at 845-334-5436. Then contact your utility company and tell them that you have applied for HEAP. It is also important to pay what you can when you can. Even small payments will help prevent your utility account from growing over time. Additionally, you can discuss affordable payment agreements with your utility that will help you pay off your balance over time. For more information, go to utilityproject.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
It's music.
Hi, I'm Annie Nero. Join me Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. for Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Each week, we'll come up with a musical theme. It could be anything at all, a theme loosely related to something going on here in Kingston. We'll stretch that theme so far that it's unrecognizable, but the theme will always be there.
It's music.
Like a jazz improvisation that goes so far out but returns to its standard melody. There's no genre of music, just a theme. Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm Chris Baker, filling in for Laurel Sutherland, and my guest today is the seed huntress, Sephra Alexandra. And we've just been having a fantastic conversation about stewarding eco-regional seed. Yeah. And
yay, new words.
Yeah, learning a lot of new words and getting some really practical advice. And to finish up our hour, I'd love to talk a little bit about the concept of seed guilds, because this was a new one for me and it seems to have a lot of wisdom to it. What are seed guilds, Sephra?
So, all right, you are such a lover of nature. You know, when you're walking out in the forest, because I know, I'm sure everyone who's listening knows, but Chris is quite the mycologist, mushroom expert.
I'm an amateur mycologist.
Okay, amateur. Yeah. I think I'm an amateur seed huntress. Right? We're all. The more you know, the more you know you don't know. So it is a lifelong path of the naturalist realm. But as you're out observing all the mushrooms, right? You're also observing who else grows together,
right?
Have you seen that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, with mushrooms, it's a lot about the host plants or the medium that it's growing on. Yeah, so you have to kind of know your plants in order to know where to find the mushrooms if you're looking for specific ones.
Exactly, and so that's a guild, right? So when we're outside, we're seeing, okay, well, whenever I see this shrub, I see it growing with this tree, and then there's kind of these ground covers, right? And you're just noticing what's the natural community that grows together in a dry, shady area, in a sunny, wet area, in a dry, sunny area. And so extrapolating on that concept, it's if we're truly, again, doing this restoration, we're not just trying to do these monocultures of one species.
Right.
We don't just, I mean, you don't see huge stands of milkweed all growing together. They're interdispersed with other native plants in their communities. And so what we just launched at the Northeast Seed Collective are these seed bundles, these seed guilds, right? And so let's think about what grows in the dry shade. Well, you have, like, you know, the red columbines, your white wood asters, your broadleaf mountain mints, your forest goldenrods, your blue wood asters. And those are some of the things that we see when we're walking underneath the forest. And it's important to plant in these guilds, because the other thing that that's doing is those species all have different bloom times, right? So I heard this woman say from the South, it's like inviting house guests over for a week and only feeding them on Monday, y'all, right? They're like...
in terms of if you're trying to...
Feed pollinators.
Feed native wildlife.
You want to make sure that your gardens have these... have species that are blooming, you know, early spring, late fall, early winter. You just want to make sure you're covering so that there's food throughout the seasons. So these guilds also help to cover those types of things, right? And then so we can say, oh, well, what grows in sunny dry? We have like our yarrows and our wild bergamots and our foxglove beard tongues and our, you know, our goldenrods and our New England asters. And I mean, not even to talk about
Just like visualizing all these growing together. I mean,
it's a
like,
party.
It's and when you think about it visually, you're like, that sounds like this looks like a healthy ecosystem, you know, like with when you think of all those plants together.
Yeah. And I'm not, you know, an entomologist, but like the symphony of ecology that happens in these seed stands, it's like there are these little caterpillars that like cover their backs with petals and bugs, like good bugs, right? But all these beneficial insects, and like, are the farmers that we worked with, their wages are paid on the backs of pollinators. If the food and habitat that they need, the pollinators need, isn't there, well then the food that we need for local food security isn't there, right? And so the more diversity you have on your landscape, the more beneficial insects you have on the landscape, which is the natural pest management. And then we come back into this beautiful homeostasis, right? So it's this really amazing thing that happens. And so excitingly, like this next grant that we're working on is for forest farming species, is increasing the amount of ecotypic seed that will be available for these value-added species that happen in that successional environment in between like a meadow and a forest. So your elderberries and your sumacs and your, you know, blackberries, even the Allium trichocum, right? The ramps, these species that have such celebrated culinary and medicinal values. But we want to make sure that we're proliferating, again, that locally, eco-regionally, genetically adapted varieties.
And so in order can we shout out the website where people can go if they want to read about the new plant guilds and maybe think about it for their next season?
Yeah, sure. So there is the ecotypeproject.org website, which has more of the educational side of things. And we also have a great map on there that it shows you where seed collectors are, where nurseries are, where seed cleaning facilities are. And if any of you work in those regards, reach out to be added to that. And then the Northeast Seed Collective is where you can find winter sowing kits and these new seed guild bundles and just a ton of information about the importance of, proliferating these eco-regional seed sheds. And, you know, together with that one seed in your hand, you know, we all have such an amazing opportunity to help just steward these lands back to health. And
thank you much for being here, Safra.
Thank you, Chris.
This has been an amazing conversation. And thanks to everyone also for listening to Nature Nuggets today here on Radio Kingston. I'll be back again next week. And please feel free to email us with suggestions or questions by contacting naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. You can also follow the Nature Nuggets Instagram account, which is @HVNatureNuggets. Thanks so much.
Save seeds, seed saves.
You'd already left town to the city. Hey, love, you stay pretty and now. Where should I go? I'm all alone. Up here in the snow. I'm in the mountains by the hole. Thank you. myself to you completely.